Well, welcome to Firefighter Behavioral Health with Dr. Beth Murphy. This is John Murphy, who will be running her dashboard tonight. And we're anticipating a guest, so we're waiting for the guest to show. So we'll sort of fill in with information that deals with the change in FDIC that will be now from August 2nd to August 7th in Indianapolis, Indiana. We hope to see everyone there. Dr. Murphy will be there, but not speaking this year, but we'll be in attendance as the lawyers will be there this year speaking, and even with the change in the dates. The other thing is, just for a public service announcement, and being that I do have a healthcare provider hat on, that everyone that is eligible and when available, that the you take advantage of any sort of COVID immunization that's out there. There's a lot of them on the market today that's being administered, shots in arms. And so we encourage you to be a part of the sort of the war on a virus that harms America and Americans. And so we hopefully you'll take advantage of that sort of program in your community, or you may be the one that's administering those particular immunizations. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Dr. Beth Murphy, retired firefighter and doctor of psychology. Dr. Murphy.
Hi.
Drum roll,
hello. So I'm looking at the dashboard too. So I was like, am I still on hold? But I'm not. This is why I
You're
should
live.
Not be looking
live
at
and
the,
in person.
I should. Oh, good. Yeah. So I shouldn't be looking at the dashboard because it's just a bit confusing.
No, I'll take care of that. That's why you hired me.
Exactly. So as John said, I am a psychologist. So I have a private practice, and I work with firefighters and police officers, and work with a lot of people who experience different types of traumas. And so I thought today, oh, and then a guest. So we are going to have a guest calling in. I think she's going to be calling in about 15 minutes or so. And I wanted to invite her on because of her area of expertise. I thought it would be informative and definitely informational. So today we're going to be talking about PTSD, and more we're going to focus more on the hyper arousal part of like what it feels like in the body, and then also touch on some, I guess, like lesser understood aspects of PTSD, and then like treatment modalities, and that was one of the biggest reasons why I invited this particular guest to come on, because she is she specializes in doing equine assisted therapy, and I thought that would be really interesting. I actually have a couple clients who are first responders that have PTSD, and they either are going into or have been in some sort of treatment for PTSD. And both of them used or were exposed to in some way equine assisted therapy, and one of them actually has his own horse and continues to work with his horse as well as volunteering with a group that has horses. And I don't know if they do equine therapy or if it's just the interaction with the horse at that point. And excuse me for sniffing or if I cough. I have I have allergies, and they decided to flare up. So I wanted to talk about the physical symptoms, but also some of the lesser known ways that PTSD expresses itself, because I often see clients who come to me and they, you know, they think they have PTSD, but they think they have depression or anxiety or both. And they often have a diagnosis of one or both of those prior to coming to me. And the reality is that they really do meet criteria for PTSD. And so they get kind of hung up on the re-experiencing symptoms, and those are the ones about having nightmares or flashbacks, and they don't really understand what that is, because it's not always like what you see in the movies. So I wanted to talk about that a little bit. And then, like I said, then the physical symptoms and what that feels like. So hopefully, after listening, you'll walk away with a little different understanding, and then maybe recognize when something's going on sooner than later, and then be able to get some sort of treatment or intervention earlier. So, and it is possible that you could have some symptoms and you don't rise to the level of having PTSD, like the full criteria, but still getting help earlier would be so beneficial. So anyway, so I'm going to start out with the first criteria of, well, how about if I just go through it really quick, the whole criteria, and then focus in on where sometimes people don't realize they're really experiencing a PTSD symptom. So the first, obviously, is that you have to learn about or experience repeated extreme exposures to like aversive details to a traumatic event. So directly experiencing it, of course, is, you know, having that direct experience of a life-threatening something, like a near-death experience, an injury, an illness. I mean, so it could be a car accident. It could be being in a fire and running out of air, or falling through the roof, or having to dodge out of the way of a speeding vehicle at a freeway call, or getting hit at a call. Those are direct experiences, because it impacts you and threatens your life. And then witnessing in person, so as the event occurs, yeah, that would be like if you're you know, standing on the street, or you're in your car even, and you see like a car accident right in front of you. So that would be directly witnessing it. So your life is not threatened, but you watch this unfold right in front of you. Learning about the traumatic event, it's specific to like a close family member or close friend, and it could be an actual or threatened death of a family member or friend. So it could be, I mean, this is one of the things that it has been so hard, like now with COVID being, you know, basically we're in this over a year, and so there are people across the country that are basically learning about friends and loved ones who are getting sick and being put in the hospital or worse, dying. And so that's considered a traumatic event for post-traumatic stress. And then, I think because we've heard it so much that you could even expand that a little bit where it could be, you know, like a family member, but it's the close friend of the family member. I mean, so it seems like because it's just so unrelenting that people are impacted more and more by learning about these COVID events, expanding out from their, you know, their direct circle, if you will. So this is definitely an example of where people are being traumatized. And then experiencing repeated or extreme exposure to the adverse details of the traumatic events. So this is where first responders like are often categorized. So it's possible that, you know, you could check all those boxes and or maybe it's just where it's like, well, this is part of my job and this is what I see, this is what I experience. And so it's not just about this is where that vicarious traumatization comes into play. So, I mean, so like therapists and psychologists are there too, and doctors. But that's basically where you're not like directly affected. So you're not directly put into a life-threatening event. However, anybody on the job knows that everybody has some sort of close call. I remember being on a freeway call and having to jump onto the side of the ready boards and the side of the engine. Now, I don't know if I would have actually been hit if I hadn't jumped up on the engine, but it really felt like it. And I didn't know I could jump that far or high in full bunker gear, but I did. And that's people do amazing things when they're feeling that their life is threatened. And that's due to the wonderful cascading neurohormones that are released from that. And we know it as our fight flight response. And so adrenaline is often the wonderful little hormone that is accredited with our special abilities of strength and speed and so forth and stamina. So there are a lot of ways that we can experience what they call a criterion trauma. Just kind of an aside, which I do explain to my clients, is that people, and this is not part of that criterion A trauma, and so it means that there are a lot of people who walk around with PTSD type symptoms, but they don't meet the criteria because they didn't have that criterion A trauma. And these are people who experience little t traumas. And they experience a lot of little t traumas. And so little t traumas can range from, teasing or it could be like purposeful or unintended slights, but it happens often and over a period of time to something that would be like, I don't know, it would fall just short of like a physical threat to you. So like domestic violence, it wouldn't, like, without the physical contact. So it would be somebody who is like verbally or psychologically abusive. And so a person like that would display symptoms of PTSD, but they would not get diagnosed with it because it's not recognized as a criterion A trauma. So, but how you experience it is very much the same. So those little T traumas can really build up. And a lot of those little T traumas people deal with every day in their life. And they may not recognize it. It may be just part of their life and they just find a way to deal with it. But that also, that compounds when somebody actually has experienced that criterion A trauma. And so like in the fire service, you meet that criteria because of, by virtue of your job, but you also may have experienced some trauma elsewhere in your life. And you would have experienced any number of little T traumas. And another big source of a little T trauma is how you are supported in the fire service. And so if you are not supported, not encouraged to talk about, you know, what you're feeling and experiencing after a call or any interaction within the fire service, then that can contribute to like that little T trauma, and it could be pretty significant. And that, I think that's one of the reasons why the research has shown how support has, social supports, why it's so important. It also can hurt. So if you're not supported, then that hurts, and that can compound your, basically your stress reaction. So anyway, so that's the lowdown on all the different types of traumatic experiences. And it's those little T traumas that we tend to ignore and overlook, but they are important, and it contributes to that accumulative effect. Now the rest of the criteria is having a presence of, intrusive symptoms such as the re-experiencing. So, and that's where people often will discount that they have PTSD or that they're struggling with it, because that increases nightmares and flashbacks. And a lot of people are like, well, I don't have nightmares about the job. I don't have flashbacks. And their understanding often comes from how it's portrayed in the movies. And then there's persistent avoidance. And so this is another one that people may deny because it's avoidance of or efforts to avoid distressing memories, thoughts, or feelings about or closely associated with the traumatic events. And then there's avoidance of or efforts to avoid external reminders. So people, places, conversations, activities, objects, situations that arouse distressing memories, thoughts, or feelings about or closely associated with the traumatic event. And so a lot of people practice avoidance and they don't even realize that they're practicing avoidance. So I've talked to a lot of first responders that they avoid socializing with their coworkers, for instance. Now, that because and has nothing to do with their trauma, or it could be because talking with them means talking about their calls and they just don't want to, they don't want to be reminded of those calls. They don't want to re-experience those calls. And so people will avoid other people. They may avoid places. So, like, they might be able to go to work and drive around as part of the job while they're on the job, but when they're not at work, they don't go anywhere near the city or district where they actually work, and they may not recognize that. as an avoidance either. And then the other avoidance is people get so good at pushing thoughts away and distracting themselves that they don't always recognize that they're actively avoiding distressing memories. And so they're just pushing it away or distracting from it. So that's another area where I see people denying that they have symptoms or that they're bothered by it. I have one guy that I've worked with for a little bit. He retired from the department and he retired because of PTSD. And when I just reassessed him, I noticed that he endorsed being bothered by avoidance symptoms. One was a zero and one, I think he said one. And so on the measure that we use, that means that symptom doesn't count towards the PTSD diagnosis. And you would have to have at least one of those for the criteria. And so he didn't meet it on either one. The interesting thing is that he does not go to the city where he used to work. And he doesn't talk to anybody that he worked with. And he'll say something like, well, I'm not doing it because I don't want to be, I just don't want to relive any of that. I mean, right there tells me he's still very much experiencing that avoidance symptom.
Dr. Murphy, may I interrupt?
Yes.
You have a guest. Has arrived.
Hello, guest. So this is Abby. Abby, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
So my name is Abby Crickmore. I am a licensed mental health counselor associate. So I am currently working on my clinical hours to become fully licensed. But I have training in equine facilitated psychotherapy, which is what Dr. Murphy brought me on to talk about today.
Perfect. And then you are part of the first responder family. So it's mm-hmm. John obviously is retired out of the fire service,
yep.
And I'm retired out of the fire service. So what's your connection?
Mm-hmm. So my dad is still in the fire service, although I'm not connected with him as much anymore. But my mom has been in first response and emergency medicine basically all of her life. She's worked for the fire service. She's been a 911 dispatcher. She currently teaches first responders for CPR, first aid, AED response. She's been doing programs with police officers. So I've been in and around first responders and the fire service for most of my life. And then I was also a lifeguard. So that's a first responder in another context as well. So I do have experience with that.
Yes, that is true. So I'm just kind of walking through the criteria for PTSD and just touching on where someone might deny that they have symptoms where they actually do. And that actually happens a lot. And I feel like when I go, sometimes I'm trying to convince them they have PTSD when I'm not really trying to do that, but I want to make sure that they're appropriately diagnosed. So I think I know you popped in and out a couple of times. So I'm going to finish this out, and then we're going to talk about how equine therapy helps with some of these.
Sounds great.
Okay. So we talked about avoidance. There's the negative alterations in cognitions and mood. And so this is one area which is often why people who are struggling will think they're struggling with depression, and they may get diagnosed with depression. And it's because of the negative mood piece here. But this one, it starts out with the inability to remember an important aspect of the traumatic event. And a lot of times people will deny that and they'll say, oh, I remember absolutely everything. And the reality is that, and, you know, when we do get into therapy and we start processing stuff, they actually come to understand that they didn't really remember it, or they didn't remember it correctly. So you may have people that are like, I don't remember this, or they don't, or they think they have a clear memory of the event, but they don't remember anything around it. So there's always something related to memory that shows up, and that one is often denied. There's the persistent and exaggerated negative belief about oneself, others, or the world. And I have a lot of people that will deny that one a lot because they're like, well, I don't have any negative beliefs about myself. And a lot of times it's about the other. So I see it a lot. It's that distrust in the world or not being able to trust other people or, you know, it's like they're like, well, I've heard this a lot. It's like, well, I just trust people to do stupid things. So they think that they don't meet that because of that. But they don't recognize the change in themselves, like how they think about themselves. And so a lot of them have some very negative self-talk, and they don't recognize that as that negative belief or expectation about oneself. One expectation is another important one, because a lot of times when people experience trauma, they start to become very rigid in certain ways. And in the fire service, that can look like a greater attention to detail or having a higher standard, or, you know, throwing themselves in 100% into some project, particularly when it's around safety. And then they could get quite upset when other people fall short of their expectations. And so it's like on the surface, it looks like that's a good shift. But the reality is that it actually is a negative shift. And that's an example where something that looks like a good thing can actually turn out to be a bad thing, because it doesn't allow any, it doesn't have any room for, you know, basically being human and making mistakes. And then the persistent distorted cognitions about cause or consequences. And they may blame themselves or other people. And a lot of times I see, well, I guess it's like probably about 50-50. Sometimes people will take on too much responsibility themselves. So like if I only had done this, or I'd done this better, or I'd gotten there sooner, or something like that, or blaming others. And I do see a lot of blame directed towards others. Persistent negative emotional state. So that could be the fear, horror, anger, guilt, shame, hopelessness. That one is like, people may endorse that one, they might not, but it also is often associated with, and that's why people will get diagnosed with depression. And a lot of times for men, I'll see a lot of anger and irritability. And I always have to ask them about it, because they'll deny being angry or irritable. But then I ask, well, what would your partner say? Like if they're here right now, how would they describe you? And then it's often like, oh, yeah, I guess, maybe. They did say, I seem a little angry at times and short-tempered. Then there's the markedly diminished interest or participation in significant activities. That is one that also aligns with depression. And so that one may or may not be noticed because sometimes people are like, well, I'm just so busy. I can't do these things. But I think the more important point there is that if it was something that you really enjoyed, then you find a way to continue doing it. And they're not. And the environment around COVID has also impacted people here because a lot of firefighters are pretty active outside of the job. So that activity has been curtailed, not necessarily because they chose it, but because the environment did. And so then that can ultimately kind of get in there and contribute. Feeling detached or estranged from others, that is not often recognized, but that can look like, someone who used to engage a lot with their crew on and outside the job, or maybe just engaged a lot on the job. Or they, socialized a lot more. But I think lately that's been one that's been hard to really kind of call out because, again, people have not been able to socialize like they used to. So that disconnection or that detachment often gets blamed on COVID now. But if it's on the job, they may not really recognize that that's happening on the job. But again, that's where someone else might say, hey, man, you're like keeping to yourself a lot more. And a lot of times guys will do that because they don't want to lose their temper because they're short tempered. So they may be denying that they have anger issues or they're irritable, but then they're staying away from people because they don't want to flip their lid. And then the persistent inability to experience positive emotions. And here, it's like you have to look at that as like degrees. So, somebody experiencing PTSD or depression, because this would be something that occurred with depression too, they may be able to, laugh at a joke, or they might be able to experience a small moment of joy when something really good happens. But it's mean and it needs to be bigger than it used to be. So it's like a suppression. So it's not so much an inability as a suppression of. So they might have a pretty flat state or a pretty sad state. And then have like little blips of something that might make them smile. And they may smile because there's, that's what's socially acceptable, or they may smile because they feel something, that little warming in the heart, but they can't hold on to it. So then the last one, which is, I think where I see the equine, well, I think there are a lot of places where the equine facilitated therapy helps, but I was thinking about this last criteria has to do with arousal and reactivity. And so, particularly like this exaggerated startle response or, I guess this doesn't all like, this all basically is related to your fight-flight system being on all the time. And so there could be some irritability with angry outbursts with little to no provocation. So that kind of short-tempered. So it's like a body felt sense. And then there's that reaction, which then you would see as angry. And so that could be something that's verbal and sometimes physical. So people will deny this because they don't have angry outbursts where they're acting aggressive towards other people. But then they'll talk about punching a hole in the wall. And then reckless or self-destructive behavior. And so that's often, that could be like freelancing in the fire department. That could be anything where you take an unnecessary risk, particularly at work, but also like driving fast on the freeway. Parachuting, race car driving. But it could be, you know, like binge drinking. It could be sexual activity, one night stands, that sort of thing. And those are things that people wouldn't necessarily say, well, that's a bad thing, but it is something that puts them at risk. And I would also include in there like gambling and shopping. So a lot of the things that get treated as an addiction and might be treated as a standalone are often a symptom of PTSD and are reckless and very self-destructive. Then there's that hypervigilance, so always watching for a problem. So, you know, it's difficult to relax when you're waiting for something to happen. And then the exaggerated startle response again, which I think I mentioned. And then problems with concentration. So if you're like always on edge, it really is difficult to kind of slow yourself down to concentrate on reading something or focusing on something that actually could be quite soothing for your system. And then sleep disturbance. And so that could be because of the hyperreactivity in your body, but it also can be related to the re-experiencing, like the nightmares. And so, the nightmare aspect, that's that re-experiencing either through nightmare or flashbacks, that's where a lot of people will say, well, I don't have PTSD because I don't have these re-experiencing symptoms. Because they think that they have to have this vivid image of whatever the calls are that they've been on, and that would be their nightmare or that would be what their flashback is. But that's not necessarily true. It could be a nightmare about something else that might pose a life threat to you, or a problem you can't work out, and basically your brain is trying to work that out. But you're having physiological symptoms that are similar to when you experience that traumatic event. So it could be the symptoms, and it also can be where you may not remember the content of your dream, but you woke up in a sweat and you have this sense of impending doom, and maybe not the impending doom part, but you have this fear and you don't know where it came from. And so that also could be a nightmare that would meet the criteria for PTSD. So it doesn't always have to have that, that vivid image. It could be something that is a different image and same felt sense, or it could be that you don't really have an image, but you have a strong sense that was similar to what you had at the time. So, and a lot of times these will develop after repeated exposures, and so you don't have one particular image. So that's something that's often confusing for people when they're trying to think about like what they're struggling with. And then when they go to see a professional who does not understand PTSD and trauma, then they will often get diagnosed with anxiety or depression or both. and then the provider completely ignores the fact that this person has this traumatic history, like if nothing else through the course of their job, but chances are they've experienced other traumas throughout their life because, you know, 75% of everybody, 75% of the population has had a traumatic experience. So nobody really goes into the fire service without having a traumatic experience. So that's the criteria. So the other part that can be really puzzling about all this is that people can have, like, the symptoms that may be more noticeable and more persistent for them are the, and it's difficult to do any type of work with someone who is not really in touch with their, their negative thoughts or their emotions. They just have a lot of body felt symptoms. And so if that's how they present, they may not realize that they are struggling with PTSD. And if they do, it may be difficult to work with them. And I think that was one of the reasons why I was thinking, oh, equine therapy, that sounds like that really fits with that. But I think that also helps with a lot of the other symptoms too. So Abby, this is your chance. So tell us a little bit about the equine assisted therapy and how that helps. How would that help a firefighter with PTSD?
Yeah. So the type of equine therapy that I am trained in is actually equine facilitated psychotherapy, which is slightly different than assisted. It has a bit of a it's using the horse, you're actually considering the horse as a co-therapist instead of as a tool to do therapy is the difference.
Okay, so what's the appropriate term for it then?
So it's equine facilitated. So the horse is the facilitator as well as the counselor is the facilitator as well. Are working in partnership with the horse. So the horse is considered a counselor just like the actual certified counselor, which is a really unique model. The one that I am trained in was actually developed here in Washington State by Lee Shambo. It is the Human Equine Alliance for Learning. But it's a really neat approach because this is specifically for trauma. It is working on developing relationship with the horse. It's kind of a living relationship laboratory in a way, because horses are unique in that they have a limbic system, so the emotional part of the brain, that is very similar to humans. So they're emotional in the same way we are. And we can influence their emotional state and they can influence ours. And they're very attuned to us, which is probably why horses have been our partners for millennia. So what we do in this form of therapy is actually help clients experientially to develop a relationship safely with the horse. Because the horse is non-judgmental. Horses don't hold grudges. They don't judge you for your trauma. They don't care. So they take you as you are in the moment, which is, as you know, very important with trauma work. We're trying to make it so that we can take ourselves out of the trauma flashbacks and memories and realize that it's not happening right now. So there's actually six principles in this form of therapy. The first one that we, in this process that we go through, is actually body-centered awareness. So that is getting in tune with our body, What are we experiencing? So trying to figure out, like, okay, when I am triggered, what is happening for me? When I'm not triggered, what does that feel like in my body? And this principle can be really difficult for people, especially if they've been shut off from their own emotional experiences, from their own, you know, bodily experiences too, from the trauma. I don't know if you want me to keep going through all these principles, but
oh sure, yeah,
okay. So the next one is called "The Boundaries Are the Relationship." Often with trauma, it's all about our boundaries being overstepped. Things were done to us, or we witnessed things that we didn't give consent for. And that in and of itself causes trauma. So we're actually trying to relearn how to make and maintain boundaries that are firm but fair. Horses don't understand, what's the word I'm looking for? They don't understand being tricked. They don't understand, holding grudges or, you know, somebody being mad at them for something they did yesterday. So they're always in the moment. So when we're helping clients learn how to make these boundaries, we're teaching them to be firm but fair. So, you know, for clients that are very angry, sometimes this is kind of a sticky spot. Because clients tend to, you know, if they start to get worked up and angry with the horse, that can be, you know, dangerous for the horse, dangerous for the client. So that's why we always have either counselors that are well trained with horse behavior or have an assistant that is also a horse trainer or somebody who is well versed in horse behavior so that we can, you know, step in and take a break if needed. But it's gently trying to help the client. Yeah.
Oh, so I'm sorry. I was going to say, I would imagine it, like a lot of times when somebody with PTSD is, you know, like struggling with anger, it's like they go from zero to blow up and they're not recognizing that, you know, they're starting to get bothered in some way.
Right.
And I would imagine that being with the horse that actually is a good way to help them recognize sooner, because I would imagine that the horse would start responding before the individual even knew that they were angry.
Oh, absolutely. There's a couple of different activities we do with boundaries, but one of the ones that is very common is join up. So this is, you have a horse in a pen that's round, so a round pen. The horse is free to move around within the pen, and we're asking the horse with a, stick and string, so a whip, not that the whip is used on the horse, but just to drive them. We ask the horse to move forward, and basically you're, as the client, you're in control of where the horse is going, how fast they're moving, if they're turning or stopping. So that's a lot of control. And some clients start to get very frustrated if the horse isn't listening. So that's a very direct way to, you know, have the client stop and be like, okay, what are you feeling in this moment? The horse isn't doing what you're asking. What's happening for you? And it's very clear and it's very obvious and the client can feel it in the moment. It's all about practice, right? Being able to
see
yourself to those cues. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. So the next principle that we do is actually called the divided self. So it's social incongruence and self-judgment and triggers. So I remember you were talking about, you know, a lot of clients are like, oh, I don't have negative feelings about myself. So this is the principle where that's addressed. Because horses don't judge us, because they don't hold grudges, this is, you know, a really direct way to be like, well, you know, how do you think the horse feels about you? in this moment? You know, how do you think that, you know, your horse is going to forgive you if you make a mistake? And that's why we like clients to fail in this process too.
Mm-hmm.
We like them to mess up. We like things to not work because that means that they can fail, realize it's okay, that nothing catastrophic happened, nobody got mad at them, and the horse forgave them and is willing to try again. Horses are very forgiving. You know, it usually takes a lot for a horse to not trust. So this is a really good way for that self-judgment to come up and address that. Let's see. Our next step is the yin and yang. So this is about leadership and setting goals. So assertiveness with sensitivity. That kind of goes with boundaries as well. But for a lot of people with trauma, you know, they might not have ever been in a leadership position, or they might have been told that they couldn't be, that the ability to lead was taken from them. So being able to set goals that are, you know, reasonable, that can be achieved with being assertive and sensitive. And all of that is, you know, really important in this work as well. And then
I think that would be good.
Oh, yeah.
So that one, you know, what you were just saying, it struck me that would be really useful because a lot of the firefighters I work with, I mean, they may have been officers or,
I mean,
you know, a lot of firefighters, when they've been in for years, they have a leadership role, whether or not they're actually, you know, have promoted. And, you know, regardless of that level, they almost always lose confidence in themselves and leading in some situation. I mean, for an officer, it's like they start to second guess everything that, you know, all their commands or their control of the scene.
Right.
And then firefighters may experience something similar because a lot of times here, if the, you know, firefighter shows up on scene, like in the aid car, they're in charge of it until an officer gets there. So I've seen that a lot. So it sounds like this is something that could help them like rebuild that trust in themselves and their leadership abilities.
Yes, definitely. Because horses are all about safety. Horses don't want to follow a leader who's going to lead them into danger. They want, you know, their leader to be someone who's going to protect them, make it okay. And, you know, even if they mess up at some point, you know, they, as long as it's, you know, not catastrophic, they're willing to follow you. So through this work, through building that relationship with that horse, you're building trust. Trust in the horse, and trust within yourself. So, you know, like my experience has mostly been working with kids with this model. And one of my clients that I was working with was working on this particular key, the yin and yang, and they wanted to teach one of our horses how to push a big exercise ball around. And push it through a couple of cones, so it was like a goalpost. And it took a few sessions, but it was so wonderful to watch her gain confidence that she could teach Rocky, was the horse's name, Rocky, how to push this ball through the goals, and that, you know, she was doing it with assertiveness, showing him what she wanted, using a clicker, so a little device that makes a click sound, and then giving him treats when he did a behavior that she was liking. And it's a really simple, rather simple activity, but the amount of, you know, trust she had in herself at that point, and that she trusted Rocky to be able to follow her lead, was just wonderful to experience. Our next principle is actually the art of imagination in creating positive outcomes. A lot of times what happens with trauma is we lose our connection to creativity. Creativity is such a human experience, and everybody's creative, even if you think you maybe aren't as artistic or something like that, but everybody has imagination and creativity. So when we're disconnected from that, we're disconnected from an essential human quality. So having clients actually, you know, think outside the box and figure out what might feel good to them is a big part of the process. So what we've done with kids is we've painted the horses. So using, non-toxic paints mixed with some shampoo and then on a hot day, and have them use the horse as a canvas. Paint what you're feeling, paint what, brings you joy, paint whatever you want. And that's been a really fun creative experience. Also dancing with your horse. That one's a fun one as well. Pick a song that you really like and go in the arena and try and get your horse to dance with you. That particular key can be take a while to get to, I think, especially for adults, because that, the self-criticism tends to come up at that point. So it's common for people to get stuck on the imagination part.
Yeah, definitely.
And yeah, but it can be very freeing when clients are finally able to engage with something creative that they really like. I've even had clients, just have their horse graze in a field, and they go and pick flowers, and they go and braid their horse's hair or mane and tail with flowers, or just draw a picture. You know what I mean? It's so like a wide variety of things you can do with the imagination and creativity key. and then our final key is actually the successful social brain, authenticity, and acceptance. And it's just what it sounds like. Finally having clients feel authentic and congruent in themselves, that they can accept themselves and their flaws without harsh judgment and criticism, that they can accept their horse in the same way. So this is being, trying to get, closer to being fully actualized and authentic. But yeah, those are the six keys for the HEAL model.
I like that. I can see, thinking about my own clients and their hearing their experiences, I could see how, each one of them would benefit from equine facilitated therapy, because it touches on so many of the things that I've seen. It's the trust is a big one, and it could be trust in themselves or trust in other people. And if they've had experiences where they were, when they were younger, where they, they didn't have good attachment or healthy attachment, then, there was already kind of a distrust that is there. And then, and then it's like all those little T traumas tend to be interpersonal stuff. So that can kind of reinforce that you can't really trust people. And then, once you've experienced, these big T traumas and post-traumatic and you're dealing with PTSD, then, it's like they'll lose trust in themselves, and they may, a lot of them will like question what they do, what they've done, how they've thought about something, in others, definitely.
Right.
And so I could see, kind of rebuilding that connection and then being able to trust themselves. Because if they're not trusting other people, even if they don't admit that they don't trust themselves, they're not trusting themselves to be a good, well, I don't really want to say judge because I don't like people, because people get in trouble when they judge, but I was going to say like trust their judgment, like trust their own judgment about their experience with other people and the world and that they're actually okay.
Right.
So I could see that really being helpful.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, and then I like that creativity piece is really amazing, because that a lot of the therapies, like at these treatment centers, involve some sort of creativity.
Right.
And I really like how the horse is part of that with the equine facilitated, because that people kind of lose that, and I don't think people really understand how important creativity is to their overall well-being and how they process their experiences and their environment.
Right. Well, and also with that, with PTSD, things tend to be black and white, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're helping clients be able to be creative in their thinking and their judgment as well, that there is many shades of gray.
Yes. Yes, that is very true. And then I wish I had like the list. I should have been writing down the six principles.
Yeah,
I know. And you loaned,
I can run through them again if you want.
And of course, I don't have it handy, but I was gonna.
I can run through them again if you want.
Yeah. Because I was thinking, because I had some thoughts about, like the people that I've been working with and how that definitely is beneficial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the six keys for heals. The first one is body-centered awareness.
Okay.
The second one is the boundaries are the relationship.
Okay.
The third one is the divided self, social incongruence, and self-judgment.
Okay.
Number four is yin and yang. This is leadership, setting goals, assertiveness with sensitivity.
Okay.
Number five is the art of imagination in creating positive outcomes.
And then the last one?
The successful social brain. Authenticity and acceptance.
Yeah. So that was the authenticity piece is like in everybody I've worked with PTSD is that they don't know who they are anymore. And
right.
So, talking about it being their authentic self is they have no idea who that is, or they have identified with the negative aspect of like they're broken or they're broken and they're always going to be broken. And it's interesting because they think that acknowledging that they're broken is how they're going to get to acceptance.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, but they're miserable with that. So,
right.
Which tells me, well, that clearly isn't your authentic self.
Right.
And it's not an authentic action or belief. So,
mm-hmm.
So the, what was it? So the divided self and self-judgment. What was that one mm-hmm. again? How does that get worked out with the horse again?
So this one can be kind of maybe not as obvious in your work with equine therapy. A lot of times this just comes out of the client building a relationship with their horse. They learn that, you know, this could be through watching the horses in the herd and how they interact and asking the client, okay, so, you know, Rocky just went and bit Romeo to move him. But then 10 minutes later, all of a sudden, Romeo and Rocky are grooming each other and seem very content with each other. Are they holding grudges against each other? Do you think Romeo feels bad about himself after getting bit by Rocky? So actually like processing through how the horses are reacting with each other, how you think the horses are feeling about themselves. And clients talking about the horses often are talking about themselves. So that gives you a lot of data on how the client is feeling about themselves, the self-judgment they may have. And then it's also helpful to be like, okay, well, is there evidence for this in front of us? Let's observe for a little bit here and watch how all these horses interact with each other. Because often with those self-judgment and negative self-talk and that, you know, mean voice in our heads telling us things, kind of challenging those beliefs with with, you know, logical questions and observation can be helpful. And we can do that with the horses.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can see how that is important. And I remembered when you were talking about it again, I'm like, right. That I remember. And that's something that a lot of, obviously a lot of people struggling with PTSD or depression, they really struggle with that because they are often, they misinterpret what they're viewing. And so I could see how that observation would be really powerful.
Right.
And then they're basically not living in the moment. They're very much, you know, but they're kind of, it's like they're ping-ponging back and forth from, you know, the past and experiencing the past as if it's happening today, but then going forward and then being really anxious about, you know, what's going to happen and the what ifs and what's their life going to be like, and they can't even imagine that life could be fulfilling in the future, and a lot of them have like relationship issues as a result of all this. And so, we are driven to be with other people. We're very social creatures. And so they may, try and resign themselves to, well, I'm this, you know, horrible, broken person, and nobody's ever going to love me, and I'm going to be alone.
Right.
And so there's a lot of judgment there. And I could see how observing the horses in this way could help them start to break down that whole process.
Oh, definitely. And having, you know, the horse, because a big piece of the HEAL model is actually going out, meeting your herd of horses and finding one that resonates with you. So you just have them quietly observe the horses on their first meeting, in their first session, and asking them which horse, you know, is speaking to you, which horse do you think you want to work with? And that relationship in and of itself can help to break down those barriers as well. Because they have a horse that, you know, wants to be with them, wants to, you know, share a moment with them, and can help with that self-worth, for sure.
Yeah. So have you ever seen or heard it happen where a horse just didn't want to be around a person?
Oh, 100%. That happens a lot. That's also a part of the
learning. What do you do with that?
It's a great tool because that is helping clients self-regulate. If you are, you know, feeling really keyed up, if you're feeling a lot of anger, if you're having big movements, being really loud, racing around, the horse isn't going to want to be with you. They will move themselves into a safer spot. They might turn their butt towards you, ignore you, all that stuff. It doesn't mean that you're a bad person. They probably won't even remember in 10 minutes or care in 10 minutes. But it's like a giant biofeedback machine going, okay, you're having a moment here. That's too much for me. I'm going to go over into this corner over here and you regulate yourself and then I'll come back. And often, you know, once clients are able to calm themselves, the horse is willing to come over and work with them. I remember working with a young boy who had a lot of anger issues. And when he first started, he would blow up. He often had to leave session completely because it was just, he was being, you know, it was getting dangerous. And then after he'd been working for a few months, he had a moment where his horse, he was feeding his horse carrots out of a bowl, and he got too close, and the horse brought her head up very quickly and knocked him in the head, which I'm sure hurt a lot. And you could see him, you know, he was taken aback, but he set his bowl down on the ground, turned around, went to the end of the barn aisle, kind of had his moment, collected himself, took about, I don't know, 5 minutes maybe, and then he came back and he continued. And the fact that he actually was able to stop in that moment and go, how am I going to handle this? Because I don't want my horse to go away from me at this point. I need to go collect myself. And then, you know, she'll want to be with me in this moment. And so it's stuff like that. It's totally experiential learning.
Yeah. Well, and like that story you just talked about, it's like he didn't, it's not like he, you know, stuffed it down because the horse probably would have still known, it would have still sensed that that was there. And so he actually had to get some space and then like address what it is that he's experiencing so that he could regulate and then go back to the horse.
Right.
So I think that that's really powerful too, because a lot of times the people that I work with, they're stuffing things down because they think that they're protecting the people around them, not realizing how that is sensed by them. I mean, and people like can sense other people as well. It's just most people just tend to not pay attention to it.
Right.
Or they ignore it, or they take it on like, oh, this is my problem, instead of like, you know, I'm sensing that there's some tension over there, and it's not my tension, it's like your tension. But I think, you know, it's like this would be a great thing to help teach people to actually like face and experience what they are feeling so that they can actually like move on and connect with someone.
Right. This is also tied in with, I think, emotion efficacy work that I tend to do with clients as well. I'm going to acknowledge the emotion that I'm feeling. I'm going to let it be. I'm not going to try and change it or stuff it down or ignore it, but I'm going to let it happen. That doesn't mean that I have to react to it or do something about it. I'm just going to let it happen. And oftentimes I tell clients this, it's like when you're maybe crying, you're really upset, and you're crying in front of people that you're not wanting to cry in front of. If you're anything like me, if you try and stop that tearfulness and that crying, you end up crying harder. And it comes out, and it's even more embarrassing. And then it's like a huge cycle of I'm embarrassed, so I cry harder, and I'm trying to stop myself from crying harder, and it just keeps getting worse. Whereas if I just let the tears flow, I acknowledge that they're there, it goes away much quicker. I allow my body and my mind to have its moment and to have its emotion. But I'm not letting it take over. I'm not letting it, trying to make it disappear. It just is. Mm-hmm. So that's also what we're trying to have clients do, because horses are like that as well. They don't ever try and stuff their emotions down. They don't try and ignore them. They are very open and honest with how they're feeling at all times. Their ears are the most flexible ears. They can rotate, I think it's 180 degrees or more, but they have the most rotation of any domesticated animal. And that's because it's their form of facial expression. So they express their emotion through body movement, through their ears, through physical distance, all those things. So what they're feeling is obvious. It's plastered right there, whereas humans are much much better at hiding that. So even just interacting with the horse and seeing that they're so authentic in their emotion can help clients be authentic in their own and accept their own emotions.
Yeah. Well, and I really like what you had said is, you know, you described the horse as like, well, or this process, it's like biofeedback. So when somebody is struggling with PTSD and they're having all sorts of kind of the reactive type symptoms, that definitely, if they're interacting with the horse is going to let them know, and they're going to experience that, the person's going to experience that, and then they'll be able to see how different coping strategies will help them deal with their reactivity, and they'll get to see how that works kind of in real time with the horse.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, that, because, you know, it's like I tell my clients all the time, it's you have to be very purposeful about, you know, making changes and acknowledging what you're feeling, and then trying something different and noticing how it feels, and be purposeful about it, and really like reinforce when you get a when you feel that you've changed in the direction you want to change, then you really have to acknowledge it, because when you don't have something that can help measure that change, you have to find a way to make yourself aware of it, so that the horse offers that piece and makes it very visual. Whereas if they're just doing it on their own, it might be, well, definitely it's more difficult, and they may not, you know, they may not notice it, or they may not notice it in a way that is enough for their brain.
Right. Right. Yeah, it's a thing to watch clients grow and change with this process, because you'll have clients that, you know, have never been around a horse before, and they start out very scared, very timid a lot of times, or they might come in and try and dominate the horse. And either approach doesn't work well. So they might fail a lot at the beginning. They might become frustrated, all that stuff. But to slowly watch them change into a more assertive but kind leader with their horse, so that they're able to accomplish, the goals that they set out at the beginning, is just, it's wonderful to watch.
Yeah, well, this is awesome. So I'm like so excited that you were free and could do this and talk about it. And I had mentioned when we were texting that I think this is something that we could do again.
Yeah.
So, because I just think this is amazing. And I don't know if you know off the top of your head, but if mm-hmm. if someone wanted to engage in an equine facilitated therapy, how would they go about finding that?
There are, if they're interested in this particular modality, the HEAL model, so the Human Equine Alliance for Learning, if you go out onto humanequinealliance.com, and that's all smashed together, they actually have a find a facilitator option. So these are all facilitators who have gone through the HEAL model training program, and there are people all through the U.S. There's people in Alaska, Arizona, Colorado, I mean, all over. In Washington State, there are quite a few. And all over the state, different places. You can definitely search on there. And then if you're interested in other modalities, oftentimes just typing into Google, equine facilitated psychotherapy, it'll often pop up with other practitioners of this particular modality.
Okay. Yeah. So I just put it in so that it's humanequinealliance.com, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. And then just out of curiosity, I was just going to put in, let's see, if I just put in HEAL, I get all sorts of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I always like to see like the short version is there where, so I found that like if I put in HEAL in all mm-hmm. caps, so HEAL and horses, it's like mm-hmm. my second hit on the page is humanequinealliance.com. So sounds like yeah. you can, or even if I did HEAL, what if I do HEAL therapy? I bet you that would bring it up too. Yeah, it does. So it's like right up there on the first page. So yeah, so if anybody, so it's HEAL Equine Alliance Therapy. No, HEAL Equine Alliance Therapy.com.
It's humanequinealliance.com.
Oh, no, not yet. Yeah, no, HEAL. Okay, humanequinealliance.com. Wow. Mm-hmm. I messed that up. Humanequinealliance.com. So, and if you don't remember that, then you could put capital HEAL and therapy mm-hmm. and you'll find it.
Yeah.
So, okay. Oh, good. Well, do you have any closing thoughts, comments, anything that you want to share before we end?
I'm just really passionate about this modality. I'm looking forward to eventually, having my own practice that does this as well. So, I encourage anybody who's interested in it to look into it because it's so powerful. And, even if you are not a horse person, you can do it. You don't have to have any horse experience to do this therapy. So it's applicable to anybody, pretty much all ages. And you don't have to be a rider either. You can do only working on the ground with a horse. So if you're nervous about riding, you don't have to ride. So I like to think of this modality as pretty accessible.
Nice. I like it. So, well, I cannot wait for you to get all your hours and get licensed independently so you can do this. And I just like refer a ton of people over to you. So
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I have so many people I think would really benefit from doing this. So it's like those the six keys to relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Just
yes.
sounds like it's just so applicable to everything that is affected when a person experiences trauma. So,
yes.
Yeah, I think it's amazing. So I hope everybody listening got something out of this and learned something and enjoyed my guest, Abby. And we'll go check this out and see how it applies to themselves and if that's
yeah.
something that would help them. I mean, I really want people to be able to recognize when they're struggling sooner and be able to get help. And, you know, sometimes it doesn't have to be, you know, sitting on the couch talking to somebody.
Right.
It could be
right
working with a horse.
Yeah.
So
exactly.
Perfect.
Thank you so much for having me on, Beth.
Oh, you're so welcome. I look forward to talking again.
Me too.
So I'm going to say good night to everybody, or well, I guess it could be good morning. It depends on when you all listen to this. But thank you for listening. And if anybody out there listening has any questions, they can email me at beth@integrativemhw.com. And they can contact me and I can, if they, you know, want information, more information about the equine facilitated therapy, then I can always connect them with you, Abby, to answer
mm-hmm.
questions or, you know, however that works out. But as always, if you want to contact me, feel free to email me and with questions or suggestions. Either one, I would welcome it. So thank you all and good night. And thank you, Abby, and good night to you. And
yes,
and you could say your goodbyes too.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I hope everybody has a lovely evening.
Okay, where's